We stick together, work, and don't bother nobody. We don't mix with nobody. We keep our mouths shut. No talk, just work. We don't want to become Bakui whites, and we don't want to become colored like the Hakui blacks. No, sir, those people were treated worse than dogs. We don't want that to happen to us anyhow, anywhere, anyway. We just want to be ourselves, Honging, or Chinese.
Those are the remarks of a Chinese-American grocery store owner in the segregated South. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
In the Jim Crow South, drinking fountains, movie theaters, and public restrooms were divided into whites and colored, with colored referring directly to African Americans. But what about Asian Americans, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, and others occupying a third space? If a Japanese American man boarded a bus in Arkansas in the 1940s, did he sit in the back with blacks or the front with whites? If a Mexican American woman went into labor, what hospital would take her in? How did arguments over the place of racially in-between races complicate a system based on a binary division into black and white? Joining us to discuss the complex nature of segregation is Leslie Bowe, professor of English and Asian American Studies and the author of Partly Colored, Asian Americans and Racial Anomaly in the Segregated South.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
It's a subject that I venture to say most people haven't given a lot of thought to. There's been so much over the decades having to do with other kinds of race relations in the South that the relations between non-blacks and whites are pretty much in the shadow. What got you interested in it?
Well, I think that dynamic that you're talking about exists elsewhere in the nation and not just the South. I think one of the reasons that I am very curious about how Asian Americans in particular got along under Jim Crow laws is that it reflects my own family history. Both of my parents were mom-and-pop grocery store owners, their families were, in Arkansas, and they grew up in the 30s and the 40s, where prior to 1954, segregation was still very much intact. And it's something in my own family legacy that they had not talked about a lot, you know, American relations, or even how they themselves mediated their Chinese status under Jim Crow laws. It's not as if they hadn't given it a second thought. It's that they had a very clear sense of themselves as Chinese and very distinctly separated from the race relations that went on around them. And I think that's reflective of anyone who's grown up with a sense of, I am a specific ethnicity, I'm a specific race. You think of those as being essential and fixed, as opposed to being really structurally determined and defined by the environment that surrounds you.
I didn't realize that there were a lot of Chinese Americans in a place like Arkansas. I guess maybe it's because there's not a lot of attention paid to anything other than the black-white relationship. When you look at most literature, most films, most coverage of the segregated South, it seems as if it's not a topic that's at the forefront.
Definitely not. Not necessarily reflected in the history of Southern studies or in media portrayals or in Southern literature. And I always thought of it as being a very quirky choice, the desire to settle in the South as being a very quirky choice that was simply, you know, reflective of the individualist choices of my family. And once when I was in graduate school, I went to a talk by Professor James Lowen, and he had written this book called Between Black and White, The Mississippi Chinese. And one of the shocking things to me that I had discovered once I went up and found this book, which is written in 1972, was one of the first sociological studies to take seriously this ethnic enclave of Chinese Americans living in the Mississippi Delta. And one of the things that really surprised me is that he put this community into such a kind of structural relation, understanding it as a function of black-white dynamics. Not simply taking for granted that Chinese Americans are Chinese Americans, but in fact really looking at the ways in which they fulfilled a kind of middleman economic niche between blacks and whites. In other words, they were mom-and-pop grocery store owners, and their clientele were African Americans, but they dealt with white distributors. So being in this kind of liminal, interstitial space was something that really was a kind of economic condition that arose in part because of segregation.
And what about the law at this point? I mean, we think about different court cases like Plessy versus Ferguson, Brown versus Board of Education. I think in your book you refer to some of the legal cases that, you know, were involved in trying to figure out how did the in-between people fit into the legal system.
Right. And that's one of the most interesting things when you think about, well, what is the role of the court in fixing racial status? And you know, Gong Lung versus Rice was certainly the court case that fixed the racial status of Chinese in the Delta as quote-unquote colored. In fact, it was a lawsuit that was brought against a school district in Mississippi when a Chinese grocer discovered that his daughter, Martha Lum, was turned away from the quote-unquote white school in Mississippi and told to attend school with African Americans. And that is what leveraged the suit, Gong Lung versus Rice.
And the outcome?
And the outcome was that Chinese Americans were quote-unquote colored.
That was it.
To the Supreme Court.
And what was the date for that?
I think it was 1923, I think.
Uh-huh. So well before the other landmark decisions that we think of from the 50s.
Yes, definitely. And it followed in this history of court cases brought by people of color in the U.S. that really challenged the legal racial status that they had been assigned by the courts. And so Ozawa is a 1917 very famous one that challenged the non-white status of Japanese Americans. Thind regarding South Asians was another one. But there's a whole slew depicted in this very famous legal study called White by Law by Ian Haney Lopez, which is about exactly those court cases that really challenged racial classification.
And let's say it was 1940 in Arkansas. How did someone who was Japanese American or Chinese American, Mexican American, how did they figure out where do they sit on the bus, which drinking fountain to drink from, where to sit in the theater, all those sorts of areas, or what church they could go to?
Or what hotel you could check into.
And who you could marry, all those sorts of things. How did you negotiate all those tricky questions?
You know, there are so many people who have so many stories left to tell, you know, an ethnography of exactly that process of decision making. But one of the things that I emphasize in the book that I wrote is that it does take a clear, conscious set of mediations to make the choices that people made in an environment that was so fraught. Racially, different individuals made different choices and they suffered reprisals on the basis of those choices, or contrarily, they were treated as quote unquote just like whites. You know, there were people who were willing to, you know, challenge those rules or were ignorant of those rules if they were visitors. There were people who practiced what Charles Johnson would call avoidance, which is basically, you know, not to ever put yourselves in a position in which you would have to be called to make a decision.
Some immigrant groups like the Irish or the Italian would sort of work to become accepted as, you know, equal to English and Scottish and sort of all that by practicing prejudice against African Americans, as if using that as a way to claim their own whiteness. To what extent do you think that also was a factor with Asian Americans?
In the studies that I looked at, and I think in James Lowen's work, this is definitely the narrative that comes out, that taking on the prejudices of the existing environment was certainly something that was a way of showing that they had assimilated into American cultural values. And so not arriving necessarily with the same prejudices, but as a token of learning culture, being able to show that, in fact, that they understood what the etiquette of the region was. And that is a very tricky topic because it's not necessarily to condemn, you know, a group of people as being necessarily racist themselves, but really it is a kind of case study of cultural conditioning. You know, how do you learn racism? You learn it in the same way that children learn it.
Were there that many Chinese and Japanese in the South in the years particularly before World War II?
You know, when I went to uncover the study, the archive, in other words, what was extant to convey either the scope or the experiences of Asian Americans during this time is very, very, very small. And it's also very quirky. I mean, it's my ability to talk with individuals who had had that experience, people passing on, you know, their stories of their own families who had lived in the region. But it was also things like the one or two existing WPA, you know, interviews that engaged Asian Americans during the 1930s. And so what I would say is that it is a very quirky archive, but not just that in terms of, well, there's no huge body of knowledge about it, but that even the response or the answer to what did and how were Asian Americans placed under this racial system was not necessarily a uniform response. In other words, while I pose that as the hook for this particular book, there is no singular response, yes, Asian Americans were treated like white people or no, they weren't. So even though we talked about the court case Gong Lum versus Rice, definitely there were differentials in terms of how individuals and communities were treated under the law that would obviate that Supreme Court ruling.
I'm kind of intrigued by I realize it's neither north nor south, but intrigued by reading Mark Twain's book Roughing It, where, of course, he's describing the West in the 1860s. And he has some specific things to say about Chinese and speaks of them in terms of great admiration, in terms of their industriousness, their efficiency, I suppose, in a sense, also their relative good nature, and saying that they nonetheless were always victims of all kinds of indignities and prejudice and just plain being driven out. There were a lot of Chinese miners in the West that were just plain driven out once they had broken ground and started things going. But we don't see that in the South. I gather there's just not the infusion of large groups of people as you had, say, working on the railroad and in the mines.
That was not for lack of trying. So one of the more peculiar histories that is fairly well known in terms of Asian American history was the attempt on the part of Southern planters that after emancipation to recruit so-called coolie labor to fulfill that role in agriculture in the South. And so there was actually a convention in Memphis to explore the feasibility of the large-scale importation of so-called coolie labor. And there were Chinese workers who were brought to New Orleans and Mississippi to work these plantations. And that turned out to be a dismal failure, at least on the part of the planter class, and not because Chinese were bad, slow, or inept agricultural workers. It was that, in fact, they resisted the terms of their employment, so that when they didn't like the contract that was offered to them, they would, in a body, walk off the job and quit and find better wages and better working conditions.
They did tend to be organized, didn't they, in groups? I mean, when you talk about resisting conditions and perhaps even unionizing, that's not something that we're accustomed to thinking about before the Civil War.
I don't know about the history of unionization for Chinese laborers, because that is something that I think is very occluded in Asian American history. In fact, the formal unionization of those workers was something that is definitely not a part of this sojourners, you know, type of labor history. And in any case, it was kind of obviated by the fact that immigration exclusionary laws since, you know, the 1880s were so much in place precisely to prevent, you know, any type of unionization. So to slow that importation of labor to a trickle was the response of American organized labor.
Were there laws about where Chinese and Japanese could live in the South? I mean, actual laws saying you cannot live within this part of town, that part of the state?
You know, that's really interesting because my colleague Cindy Chang here at the University of Wisconsin, in a later period in California, one of her interests is about housing covenants and restrictions in housing covenants in California. And I think maybe the absence of some of those depicted in the South is mainly due to the absence of
population. The low population density.
There wouldn't have been a Chinatown equivalent or an area that would have been had enough of a community.
Right.
Perhaps.
And but even so, what's interesting when I talk, you know, more anecdotally to folks who have lived in the South and where spatially they lived in the town, it's very much reflected of this notion of being interstitial populations because a railroad track would often divide, you know, black and white portions of a town. Chinese Americans were sometimes placed or lived in the middle of that town.
Right on the track. Very dangerous.
And associated with living behind the store or being in the merchant area as well.
You bring up in your book some of the paradoxes and ironies that can happen when you are in this kind of murky liminal space. Just read an example here that you recount in your book. A Chinese man in need of emergency surgery is denied admission to a hospital for whites, one to which his father has donated money. On being admitted to the hospital for African Americans, he is yet attended by a white surgeon and assigned a private room so he would not have to share quarters with a Negro. When his white wife gives birth to a child in a hospital for whites, he is not permitted entrance.
Yeah.
It just seems to epitomize the kind
caught
of
in the middle.
Crazy absurdity of any kind of division of people into races.
And, you know, Charles Johnson depicts that for African Americans as well, the irrationality of some of the Jim Crow laws. You know, so, for example, he depicts the prohibition against blacks and whites eating together. So he talked to someone who was sitting in a rowboat and they had to have some kind of segregation between them. So they just put a stick between the rowboat as a kind of symbolic divider to show that they weren't actually eating a meal together. Or, you know, another example is signs posted in outside of elevators in Atlanta that say that African Americans cannot use certain elevators to go up, but they can use all elevators to go down. So segregation only applied to the direction in which we're going. But I'll give another anecdote that was shared by actually a doctor, a Filipino doctor living in Wisconsin, that also shows that kind of both not just irrationality, but the kind of adjudication on a daily basis that was needed, you know, in order to understand who you were according to a specific racial schema. So he tells a story about how he came from the Philippines to accept his first post at an American hospital, which turned out to be in Maryland. And so he comes to the U.S. from the Philippines and goes to get his driver's license, in which case he goes to the DMV and he finds on the application that there are basically two racial categories, white and quote-unquote colored, for him to mark. So he looks at the application, and I remember him telling me the story because he looked down at his arm, shrugged, and checked the box marked colored. Takes it up to the DMV registration desk, and in which case the person attending the desk shakes his head, has him mark the category white, and gets his driver's license. So he drives to the hospital where he's had an assignment and finds that, in fact, the parking lots are segregated. So the attendant shows him, go, you know, park in the white lot. So he does, walks up to the hospital, and you can probably guess the rest of the story, is assigned to the quote-unquote colored ward to treat African-American patients. And so you can see even in this detail of this one day of adjudicating what his racial status, and keep in mind this was not the Deep South, it was in Maryland. You can see not just the irrationality of racial classification, but also the toll that it may take on his own psyche in trying to decide who he is and what meaning is accrued to skin color in regard to himself. And so for me, when I wrote this book, that is one of the most surprising things that I had discovered was, in fact, the degree of pathos that is involved when you are asked to internalize a sense of yourself as inferior if you had not previously experienced that.
Well, you almost are being asked, are you normal or are you inferior?
And it asks you to see yourself by an external lens. And that's what I found most both revelatory and kind of shocking about some of the autobiographies that I had read that were not actually about segregation or the impact of segregation on Asian American consciousness, but were necessarily infused with, you know, almost a gradual, you know, wandering or predicament about what race meant within the United States in the context of the South and how, you know, the psyche has definite hedges against taking in those kind of messages about inferiority and the ruptures that produces within the narrative.
More on Asian Americans in the segregated South when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. Evelyn said that she didn't want to hear what a darkie had to say. I don't generally lose my temper. Daddy G gave me strict training in controlling it, but today I did. I have been called a Negro before and been mistaken for a Negro once, and it didn't bother me, but I was enraged because Evelyn dismissed my opinion on the grounds that my skin is darker than hers. More than ever, I am determined to write a book one day and discuss this attitude that many Southern people seem to have. That's a passage from the autobiography Face to Face from 1957 by Ved Mehta. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Leslie Bowe, and we are talking about her book, Partly Colored, Asian Americans and Racial Anomaly in the Segregated South. Now, you're a professor in the English department as well as in Asian American studies. How does literature come into your study of Asian Americans in the South?
One of the interesting things about the narratives that I pulled up that were written by or about Asian Americans living in under the context of segregation was that there was a large degree of denial, and a denial that the context and the situation of African Americans had anything to do with their own placement as Asians, right? So it's seen as these are racial categories that are biological, they're distinct. What does his condition have to do with me? And you can see in that passage where you just read, there is a little bit of ambivalence there in terms of how a South Asian from India understood being quote unquote colored in terms of dark skin, and yet not having that same subjectivity be influenced by the whole history of American race relations and Southern segregation, in spite of the fact that caste is also well alive in India, and it was something that Mehta himself knew very well. And so it's interesting to me that when I go to a text like that, a lot of times people, if you are simply reading for the historical depiction of an experience, you would stay on the literal meaning of the text itself to say, well, how did this person understand himself within this particular context? Whereas one of the things that I found myself doing, and especially with this kind of quirky and anomalous history, is really reading between the lines, you know, a kind of methodology that is very much intrinsic to my own discipline of English. And so you see here, you know, if you took that at face value, the kind of statement of, well, you know, now I understand that skin color is something that is degraded and I am an outrage that they think that this applies to me. Well, that seems very straightforward in terms of how you read this work. But in many other ways, that text is very much not straightforward. And the author is himself somewhat, I would suggest, kind of unconscious about the way that Indianness is associated with blackness in the context of how he is treated within Arkansas within this boarding school. He's actually housed in the School for the Blind, and that's one of the reasons that he's immigrated to the U.S. And he did consequently end up writing 14 other books, none of which was actually about the segregated South. But it was intriguing to me that one of the instances that he reads in the context of his narrative is all about segregation, and yet he never puts it in the context of segregation. In other words, he asks if he can be, and this is a white school for the blind, in which case there is actually a potentially more famous school for the blind for African Americans that is in Little Rock. But he's placed in a dormitory with all white students at the school. And he requests, for the sake of privacy, that he'd like to have a separate room. And this request is granted. And that could be seen as like very straightforward, like the begin and the ending of the story. And yet, I find it very ironic as to the reasons that were given for granting his request, that it never occurs to him that, in fact, he is being segregated from the other white students at this boarding school, and probably on the basis of color. But the way it's articulated is you have different cultural interests. You want to listen to your Indian music without being molested. And so there's an interesting way in which you're reading narrative. Here's a way in which an individual understands his experience and mediates his experience as something that seems to be, on the surface level, nothing to do about race. But when you look at and foreground the context of the history of segregation, and even its most symbolic incarnation of Little Rock, Arkansas. And this, keep in mind, is an incident that happened just a few years prior to what we consider the historical event at Little Rock. The fact that he's moved away from the white students and into his own area of the school is really intriguing to me as a scholar, because I'm always wondering, what is the other story? What is the unsaid that is going on?
Well, there's the irony of it being a school for the blind, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're talking about a school for the blind, then how does color even matter?
And you've put your finger on the irony of that book as well, is that you realize that the scopic nature of the way that we access race, right, by physical differences, is something that is actually not available to him and most of his fellow students. And nevertheless, he comes to understand it very clearly.
Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me of some things from abroad, as when Gandhi comes from India to South Africa and is shocked when he is kicked off a train because he's trying to, you know, he's a lawyer, but he's trying to ride in the white section of the train and is kicked off the train when he refuses to go to the back. To what extent was the situation in the American South and what to do with the in-between races, to what extent did it reflect how those from India, for example, were treated when they went to Africa?
You know, a lot of people have asked about that African, especially South African context in a more contemporary period. And I think the parallelism, I think, is very clear in terms of how economic status also drives your racial classification. That in some sense, the Japanese who had invested heavily in South Africa were given the status as quote unquote honorary white. And it was simply because of the economic power that they brought with them in the 1980s. And so this sense of, you know, how does economic status accrue to racial status, or symbolic status of racial capital, let's say, is something that also exposes the kind of arbitrariness of the meanings that we ascribe to racial difference.
And, well, I suppose context, too, which is part of that. I mean, obviously, if you're a Chinese or an Indian physician who happens to be in the South, you're likely to have higher status than somebody who comes in with relatively little education and resources.
And I think that's why when you look at a book like Jane Lowen's book, which posits that what happened to the Chinese in the Mississippi Delta is that they were able to engineer what is basically a caste shift from color to white in the course of one generation, was really as a result of not just their playing by the rules, but also their ability to accumulate capital and have, you know, some economic authority in the context of those southern towns.
And also, I'm not exactly sure how it connects, but in an academic context, I mean, this I suppose falls into the category of a positive stereotype, but Chinese do tend to have a lot of parental support and excel in academic contexts.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a result of education per se, but it's interesting that, and you mentioned the academic context, one of the narratives that I read was actually by a Korean academic who came to the United States to get his degree, and he ended up working in Tennessee. And so one of the things that he was very conscious of is the way in which his status as a researcher, as a quote-unquote foreigner, impacts how people understand his racial status as he goes around doing his field work in the South. And he specifically went to American Indian and white and African American communities to do his field research, which was on pulp workers and was about labor. And one of the things that was interesting about his narrative is that he's very clear on the way in which people would be both deferential, but also the opposite in terms of how they would interact with him as a quote-unquote foreigner. And one of the things that he mediates in being confronted with derogatory or dismissive interactions, especially with white Southerners, is that he didn't attribute it to race. He attributed it to cultural difference and his quote-unquote foreignness. And so it's very interesting to me that it's not as if that disrespect did not happen. It's how he chose to think of it and mediate it and understand it, not as a racial dynamic, which is something that he could not change, but as something that was intrinsic to people's reaction to difference. And I found that very interesting, that to overwrite race as some other cause was really intriguing.
Something, yes, that you might have some control over. I mean, you can certainly, regardless of your race, assimilate pretty effectively into, I'll say, even the culture of the South, you know, depending upon how you dress, where you go to school, where you go to church, you know, the kind of things that you say, the kind of things that you buy, and the people you associate with. I mean, you can assimilate pretty effectively.
You can, but the irony about a reaction to this book, especially by individuals who actually have not grown up in the South, is that they've told me that it actually explains a lot in terms of how they understand their own treatment in the dominant culture of the United States. So even the phrase, quote-unquote, partly colored, is something that, you know, finally that they understood. What is the limit of my inclusion, you know, in a white-dominated culture? And it is always being kept at a distance or at a remove or not quite white, you know, is certainly the phrase that comes up, you know, a lot. And so the irony about, you know, having produced this work is that so many people in a contemporary period relate to it and as a way to understand their partial remove from American culture. And we're talking about people who have grown up here and are very assimilated. But to understand the approximate association to African Americans and being racially objected in not quite the same way, but a related way, in ways that are like interstitial but not quite to being white Americans.
Do you find, as you kind of explore some of the history, a lot of examples of Orientalism where you have whites in the South who are lumping together Chinese-American, Japanese-American, Korean-American, Filipino-American, and also making stereotypical assumptions or treating them as exotics? Or, you know, what kinds of examples of prejudice and stereotyping that we might associate with the Orientalism of, you know, if you think of a text like Madame Butterfly or just different things, different perceptions.
Result of World War II, where Chinese were the recipients of some of the rising prejudice against Japanese?
You know, I think of that as such a national question that so much transcends the regional, that,
sure.
that you can come up with so many examples. And I think I'd answer that a little more abstractly in terms of a larger dynamic that I think definitely accrues to Asians in the United States. But in terms of racial minorities, the dominant trope, you know, in terms of race studies has been the notion of racial hatred. And what's so intriguing to me about Asian Americans is that they're constantly represented through the lens of what Asian American writers have called racist love. In other words, it's not simply that you're the object of derision and abjection and racial targeting, but then you're also the object of a kind of an extreme projection of the model minority, of what you would been calling, you know, stereotyping or Orientalism. And to try to understand, you know, that dynamic has been so intriguing about, you know, why Asian Americans themselves are an occasion for so much cultural ambivalence within the United States. I know that the Pew report on Asian Americans just came out this June, and it began with, you know, potentially inflammatory statement that said that is very indicative of what we could call racist love. And it said something like, Asian Americans are the fastest growing, the best educated, and the highest income of any racial group in the United States. And of course, to make a statement like that, at one level, it was based on their data. But of course, it is very partial. You know, it excluded a lot of Asian ethnic groups. It did do that lumping together process that you talked about. Well, you know, here is a conglomerate identity that kind of feeds into this idea that Asians are the best, most strict parents, the best educated, the best students, the most competitive, you know, the highest income. And so we have all this projection of not just you know, the same kind of vilification, but in fact the opposite.
Right.
Right.
It's a stereotype either way.
Right. Which reveals that it's just the flip side of that same coin.
Well, and the phrase you use, racist love, is definitely an oxymoron.
You know, absolutely. And I think very self-consciously when you think, well, what then are the needs of the nation that are fulfilled by that kind of projection on this one group? You know, where I fear, but I desire to be a parent like the tiger mother, you know. You know, so this kind of, when you ask about the nature of stereotypes, I think it's absolutely true that what's most intriguing about race and Asian Americans is that so much of the dynamic goes both ways. And I think so the history of this book, Partly Colored, is partly to uncover a racial history that in many ways has been repressed. What is Asian American association with African Americans? And repressed because of this dominant trope that now has taken over in terms of the projection of this desire or love or promotion of the model minority that Asian Americans represent in this culture.
One group of Asians that we haven't mentioned yet that did have an impact in parts of the South, largely because they were just injected into it in recent years, with the Vietnamese fishermen that you find in, you know, Louisiana and Mississippi, for example, and Texas, I think, Gulf Coast of Texas, where they were not welcomed by the local fishermen because, of course, they were competitors.
You know, and there's been a documentary now called A Village Called Versailles, exactly about the Vietnamese American community in New Orleans and the ways in which, because they were neither black or white, at least this is my reading, they were erased from the rebuilding and the discussions about rebuilding of New Orleans that took place after Katrina. And so to come, you know, as a community, as a population, and then necessarily have to make themselves visible to a very integrated city council, you know, in New Orleans was something that, you know, I think Asian American marginalization, not only having to compete in terms of labor, but also in terms of visibility, if the schema, the racial schema is a black white one. And so you could see the ways in that, in which that case of this one community was very much on the level of local politics. But one of the intriguing things about the book that I've written, but also the studies that I'm doing now, is that you can take that to its next level and say, what about the notion of visibility and how is that delimited by that black-white framework that is so much intrinsic to how we read race in the United States?
More on partly colored Asian Americans and racial anomaly in the segregated South when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Leslie Bow, who is telling us about what might be called the social racial ambiguity that has been a way of life among many Asians, particularly in the South of the United States over the years. As we come to this point, Leslie, give us a summary of your experience or your findings so far and tell us where are you going to go from here?
Well, I set out to write what I at first thought was a very simple book exploring the idea of regionalism in Asian Americans. And I think it got bigger and bigger in terms of not being a history or a community study, but providing a kind of framework for thinking about Asian racialization in the U.S. and characterized by the notion of betweenness or interstitiality that was conditioned and legislated by the segregation era. So being between black and white and having that ambiguity or anomaly having to be adjudicated and mediated and understood by individuals as very much part and parcel of a process that extended beyond regionalism in the South and also beyond the idea of Jim Crow and the historical limits that were placed on that historical time period. And so when I think in the future, thinking of working with the notion of, well, how do you understand race in the United States as being conditioned by a very dominant black-white paradigm or black-white lens, so that anyone who becomes race in the United States has to somehow be understood within that kind of paradigm. And thinking also about one of the movements in this the so-called post-racial period, and thinking about our contemporary moment, how that framework infuses our contemporary moment. A phrase like post-racial certainly has, you know, a lot of connotations in terms of our preferred notion of colorblindness. And when you think of Asian Americans in particular and how they've been located as, you know, as a group that can transcend racial barriers, and in some sense, you know, what's interesting about the book that I've written is that sense of caste transcendence would almost seem to support that kind of narrative. But I wanted to bring it back to a little bit of what I was talking about before, which is the duality between racial hatred and racist love, and the latter, which we do not really understand very deeply as part and parcel with the way in which race works in the United States. And so what I'm working now on is a kind of idea of metaphorical substitution and the way that race, in spite of our protestation that we're in a post-racial period or that we are a very colorblind nation, the way in which race has infused even, you know, all our kind of cultural media and all our advertising in movies and literature, but in a way, in a kind of underground way, in precisely this study is kind of an underground study of race. In fact, it is a book that is really about black-white relations. And so using Asian Americans as a metaphor to understand the way in which we mediate race in a kind of post-racial moment kind of comes from that context. And I keep thinking about the reason why racialized characters appear in fantasy manifestations. And so you could see in many ways the fascination with zombies or vampires or, rapping hamsters, or even I took my daughter to see Madagascar 3, in which all the characters, the cartoon characters, have accents, which locate them in a specific racial way, the ways in which that kind of goes underground, so that race is ever present, but it only exists now in a kind of metaphoric way.
There's a Langston Hughes poem called Merry-Go-Round, where a black child realizes he doesn't know where to sit on a merry-go-round and says, "Where is the horse for a kid that's black?" Mm-hmm. And it kind of points to the absurdity of the whole system. I would have thought that some of the questioning of, where would a Japanese-American person sit on the bus or what hospital go to, I would think that it would have opened up discussion of the absurdity of racism in general. Did you find any of that, where discussions of the place of Asian Americans actually helped to explode the whole category of race?
And that's interesting, because as an academic, you think, of course, that's exactly where, here is an anomaly that cannot bear the contradictions of what we consider, quote unquote, normal, as a way to categorize society. And in fact, that didn't happen. And that's, certainly the claim in this book, is that not that it overturned in any way the system of legal segregation. In fact, the power of the normative is what comes through in this book, where you begin very much as an outsider to a system, to acculturate, to understand, and likewise be accommodated by it. So that's one of the surprising things, that culture changes very slowly.
Are there any films or literary texts that you would especially recommend as, I guess, maybe highlighting the complexity of this issue? In other words, some of us may see a film that is about Native Americans or has an Asian American character in it, mm-hmm. or families, as in, say, Joy Luck Club,
yeah.
or different texts that get to be popular. I'm curious both whether there are ones that you think are dangerous in the stereotypes that they promote, or if there's others where you think they really are clarifying in some ways.
You're asking me a really interesting question, because as an academic, you tend to go for the works and valorize the works that contain both of those messages simultaneously. So one that I would recommend, which is a very beautiful yet intriguing and also disturbing work, is actually a children's picture book by Sean Tan, and it's called The Arrival. And what it does is depict the immigrant experience without words and without an actual location. It's a fantasy location that he portrays. And the way in which he relies upon archival imagery of Ellis Island, for example, but riffs upon the notion of disorientation by having a made-up language and made-up food and made-up creatures, it really asks us to experience the newcomers' acculturation experience, but using fantasy as a medium. The question of, is that a better way, to portray real history or real disorientation with culture, or is it a universalizing approach to say, I'm going to de-link anything from Ellis Island or any kind of immigrant experience, or the picturing of someone's racial difference, or racial history or discriminatory history as a reason for seeking out a new land, to pose that question in terms of like a shared trauma of immigrants, but not a real history, but in a fantasy
history.
More of a
universalized.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And in fact, the immigration stories, for example, echo in this image, echo the Holocaust, but not by Nazis, but with giant soldiers with vacuum cleaners scooping up tiny, figures. And so there's a way in which there's a whole history of racial and religious oppression that's being conveyed there that riffs on what we know about real history, but at the same time is very much fictionalized. And so to go back to the question that you asked, Emily, is that a more effective way to especially inculcate children into the notion that, you know, we all come to the United States or Australia, you know, or anywhere that we immigrate to for different reasons? Is it a more efficacious way of asking them to identify with that notion of immigration and dislocation? Or is it a cheat? You know, is it actually evacuating what we know of as real history and placing it into some kind of faraway place and unknown land?
Well, I mean, that's a most common literary device in the world is to make a metaphor out of the real.
Absolutely, and that's why The Hunger Games is so popular now. That's
isn't that the truth? I have to say, though, that I think it doesn't apply to the South, but it gives some sense of the Chinese immigrant experience in America in fairly recent years would be Lisa See's Shanghai Girls.
Yeah, I haven't read that myself.
You get very much, I mean, it's set in California, but you get very much the holding pattern that the Chinese were put into. And we're talking about, in this case, World War II era.
And holding in Angel Island specifically?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And that whole kind of processing and the exclusion zones and the whole thing and keeping the family intact, but it becoming Americanized and somewhat fragmented all at the same time.
And it was shocking to me, knowing a bit of the history of Angel Island, to actually go to Ellis Island and find out a little bit more about
it. Wasn't the only one.
And to find out that European immigrants were not even held overnight. You know, they were processed immediately if they could be.
Yes, we're talking about months at Angel Island.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You point out, I don't remember if it was in an article by you or in the book, but some, I guess, quintessentially American moments where you have Chinese Americans saying y'all in the South, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm, cooking Creole food in a wok, mm-hmm, or this sort of fusion. Is that kind of fusion something that you see as being held up as a model in a way that, again, is a bit disturbing because it implies a blend, or is it something that you find in terms of the text that you've looked at to be exciting?
You know, that it's intriguing because the idea of the culturally hybrid is something that's always been associated with Asian Americans. And so there is a little bit of the intended irony and shock value of having exactly the Asian American be the Southerner. You know, so I find it very part and parcel, I guess I would, mm-hmm, say, with the way in which the simultaneity of the ways in which Asians are marked as both similar and different becomes enacted as a kind of commodity within the United States, that we like the culturally hybrid figure.
That's true. There is a certain endearing quality, isn't it, because they are becoming one of you to some extent.
And when you think of it in much more abstract terms, what is the work of the familiar doing in the context of that kind of hybrid image? Why would we celebrate the notion of a culturally hybrid food? You know, it's exactly, mm-hmm, that kind of like stir frying, you know, or collards in a wok, you know, kind of imagery. It's like, well, yes, that's how we celebrate ourselves, is the melting pot, is actually, sure, to put forward exactly those kinds of images that, In many ways, that kind of celebratory gesture is a kind of represents a kind of repression of exactly the history that I've talked about here.
But it is, in a way, too, a celebration of adaptation.
Right, right. And it kind of glosses over that adaptation actually took place in a much more abjected racial,
yes,
sense,
sure,
as,
yes,
well.
With a lot of,
came at a price.
With a lot of pain.
Right.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of cost.
Absolutely.
Our guest has been Leslie Bowe. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.